Session number 8177.
Wing Commander Shannon, Reel 3. Hopwood's run in attracted tremendous flak, and he was hit and hit in one of the petrol tanks because one wing on the starboard side, his wing on the starboard side, caught fire, and I think his bomb aimer must have been hit because the bomb was released late and bounced over the wall, and there was a tremendous explosion. Hopgood did his best to gain height, and he'd gained, I suppose, 400 or 500 feet when the entire aircraft exploded in midair beyond the dam wall in a steep climb. And goodness alone knows how it happened, but one survivor from that terrible smash was his rear gunner, Bircher, who was taken prisoner of war, who obviously was blown out and must have had sufficient sense to pull his parachute cord, and he was taken prisoner of war. He was the only survivor of Hopgood's. So that second bomb against the Mona Dam, the wall was still standing. The next chap to go in was Mickey Martin, and the same thing happened again. He was hit several times going in, but to try and draw off some of the flak, Gibson was flying down one side of the lake, just out of range of the flak, but with his navigation lights on and his spotlights on under the aircraft to try and fool the gunners, which was a bit of a spoof, but it did work. He drew some of the fire off. Martin's bomb was released, as far as we could tell, exactly on site. Again, there was this tremendous, vast explosion of water up into the air, and then when the whole thing had subsided again, the wall was still there. So the next Vic was called in. The leader of that was Squadron Leader Young, Dingy Young, as he was known. And this time, Martin also was flying down one side and Gibson on the other, trying to draw the fire to get some of the flak away, to give the flak gunners three aircraft to shoot at rather than one. And this worked to a certain extent. Young dropped his mine again, as far as could be assessed, in the right place. Again, there was a tremendous explosion of the water. Young called up and said he thought that the war would go. As far as he could tell, it had been a perfect run, but when it subsided, the war was still standing. The next one to go was Maltby, who was flying his number two. The same procedure was carried out again, and Maltby, as far as he could tell, again had dropped his bomb in exactly the right place. Again, we had this tremendous explosion of water and settled down, but still the dam wall was there, as far as they could see. I was then called in by Gibson to start my run, and I was just starting the run, and Gibson was flying down one side and Martin was flying down the other side. When there was a tremendous, I can only explain it as a sort of excited yells over the RT, that it's gone, it's gone, it's gone. And the whole wall had collapsed and the water had started spewing out down the valley. And so Gibson rapidly said to me, he said, "El Love," which was my aircraft, "steer off the run and stand by. I think it's gone." And then he came back and said, "Yes, it has gone." And they circled and saw that the whole thing had gone. And so we then moved across to the Ada Dam, the aircraft that were left. Martin was, and Maltby were told to return to base. Young, as second in command, was told to come with Gibson and to master bomb and control the bombing of the Ada Dam to see what was on there. By this time, it was getting on, and the mists were starting to form across the hills and down in the valleys. And the route was about 60-odd miles, I think, we had to fly toward Castle to find this Ada Dam. And with the mist in the valleys and the water in the valleys, there's a tremendous amount of water. That's a huge dam. The Ada Dam is even bigger than the Maiden Dam, and it's a sort of two long arms, two long legs of the dam. It was difficult to see what was what. And Gibson eventually got there, and said he was the only aircraft there. And so he called up and said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, I called up and said I was in the vicinity. I wasn't quite sure. In fact, I was making a dummy run on what I thought was the dam, and it was another arm of the Ada Dam, which looked very similar in the light. So he said, "Well, stand by, I'll fire a very light." And so he fired a very pistol, and I said, "Ah, yes, I see now." And all the aircraft said, "See," so we moved over to where this light was and found the Ada Dam. Well, the Ada Dam was not protected by any anti-aircraft defences at all. I think the Germans had thought that it was so difficult to for anybody to achieve with its natural surrounding that it was quite secure. It was way down in the valley, in a very steep valley, and we were flying there above the hills, I suppose above the level of the water of the dam, in the dam, we were at about 1,000 or 1,500 feet. There was a castle at one end of the lake over which we had to, we judge this from the briefing, we had to drop down immediately down the side of the hill, level out over the water, go over a spit of sand that was jutting out into the lake, and then the dam wall was on beyond that. Well, I tried, I think, four times to get down, dropping down, and each time was not satisfied with the run that I'd made, and so told the bomb owner not to release, that we wouldn't release. To get out of this predicament, we had to immediately put on full throttle and do a steep climbing turn to the right to avoid a vast rock face that was up in the front. So the approach on the Ada Dam was it was fairly hairy, I suppose one would say. So then Gibson said, "We'll have a rest of that, you know," and called in Maudsley, who was the leader of the next flight to come along, and he had one dummy run at it, unsuccessful, and did the same thing that I'd done. Then he did another dummy run and dropped his bomb, but the bomb overshot and bounced over the wall and again exploded below, and there was tremendous flash, and we don't know what happened to Maudsley, but whether he was shaken. His aircraft was never found and he never returned. So then Gibson told me to have another go, so I had another dummy run. And then I got what I thought was an excellent run down, and we released the mine. And as far as we could tell, there was a small breach made on the port side, on the left-hand side of the wall, going through. But there was no significant sign there, and so there was only one aircraft left. That was Les Knight, and he was called up, and he had three or four runs before he could actually release, and then he released his mine, and I think what his mine together with my mine, his was at the same place the wall gave. So fortunately we were very lucky, because that was the last of the nine aircraft, and that breached the Ada Dam. So having seen that and seen the water spew down there, immediately all the lights down in the valley which had come on from the power stations were all flooded and through there, and that one went. So group was told that that had been successful. The code bird was sent back. The Ada Dam was burst. And we were told to fly back to base at low level as soon as possible. So we left the area and took the similar route back to the route in that we'd come in, going back. Again, going back, the defences were much the same as they had been coming in. There was quite a lot of searchlight and night flak going through, but we got through. And fortunately for me, we weren't hit at all. We got through, crossed the North Sea, and back to base. I suppose landed about 4 o'clock in the morning of the 17th of May.
Were you not hit at any stage during the whole raid?
Not. We were unscathed during the whole stage.
You talked about the difficulty of finding the Ada Dam, but had there been any difficulty in finding the Myrna?
No, the Myrna Dam was no difficulty at all. We went straight there. The Ada Dam, the difficulty in the Ada Dam was that there were all sorts of other dams in this hills area around there to pick out the Ada Dam. As I said earlier, with the mists were starting to form, it was by then sort of two in the morning sort of time, getting on for 2 o'clock in the morning. One or 2 o'clock in the morning, I suppose it was then. The mists were starting to form, and the fog in the valleys, which forms on a summer night, as you know, coming up off the water, and it made it very difficult to tell whether there was water under the mist, or whether it was mist on the water, or water or what. That was the problem. We would have found it without a doubt, because we realised when I was doing the dummy run in that it was not the dam that we were running in on. That it was this false leg. There was another dam wall there, but of course it was only a minor dam wall compared with the main dam of the Ada, the main retaining wall.
Was there any mist in the area of the Myrna Dam?
No, that was quite clear, quite clear.
Can you? Did you have a very good view of the Myrna Dam when the others were going in?
We could see back from there. We could see them doing the run in, and we could see the burst of water coming up. We were standing back, as I say, about 4 miles away, 3 or 4 miles away back. But we couldn't actually see whether or not the dam had broken from where we were circling, waiting for our turn to go in. But we could see what was happening over the dam itself and over the dam wall. We could see all the flak coming up. We could see the aircraft doing their run in. We couldn't actually see the release of the bomb. That could be seen by Gibson, who was there flying around immediately in the vicinity right on the top. So all we saw each time that there was a bomb released, we saw the explosions of Hopwood's aircraft, of course. We saw the explosion of Hopwood's bomb, because that was the... you got the flash of the bomb exploding because it was not in the water. It exploded on impact, of course, that bomb, when it hit the ground. And we could see the huge geysers of water that went up into the air when the bomb had exploded in the water.
What was the atmosphere in your plane when you saw all these attacks going in and apparently not succeeding?
Well, the atmosphere is just one of, you know, you're concentrating on what you're doing, and one doesn't have a time. You know, once you're flying over enemy territory, you don't have any feelings at all of that. You're just concentrating on what you're doing and waiting your turn to go in and bomb. But one could see that there was flak there, but, I mean, we'd all seen flak before. I mean, this was, you know, there was nothing, nothing new as far as that went. And there was nothing new in the flying because we had done all this training for the flying.
But was there any depression or build-up of tension because they weren't apparently succeeding?
Well, I think, no, I don't think there was any tension or depression. I think there was disappointment. I think one would just express it as disappointment that we had been told that one of these bombs placed in the right position would explode, would blow up the wall. And... I think with hindsight, one can only feel and assume that perhaps they were a few yards off, and perhaps they were exploding in the water, presumably just a bit short of the wall, and not giving its full force.
What did the Eder Dam look like as you went in to make your approach? Can you describe the low-level view?
As I say, there was this huge castle stuck up like an eagle's nest in an eyrie, a sort of Gothic castle, right up on a point, and we had to fly over that and then drop down. It was wooded and rough land, and scenically, it was rather beautiful. Situation of this particular lake or reservoir, but not the sort of place to try and get in with a four-engine aircraft and get out again and get down to 60 feet and do your run at, get your speed at 232 miles an hour and then have a sheer rock face at the end of it to climb up over the top. But the dam itself was in all of those dams in the most beautiful locations there in Germany.
Taking an overview of the training which you'd done, in view with the benefits of hindsight of actually doing the attacks, was there anything in the training which you think could have been added or left out? How adequate was the training for the job?
Oh, I think the training was absolutely adequate for the job. The limiting factors were the time. One can go on and on and on, but as I say, we had probably averaged 100 hours per crew training, specific training with the formation flying, the low-level flying, firstly at 150 feet, then down to the 60 feet. We had all dropped probably upwards of 100 or more practice bombs. We had all dropped a mine. We had all had practice on the VHF radio communications. So I think training was absolutely perfect and adequate, that any further training, I don't think, would have achieved any different result from the result that was achieved.
What's happened when you got back?
Well, where the debriefing took place, AOC of five groups, Sir Ralph Cochrane was there, the CNC of Bomber Command, Sir Arthur Harris was there, Barnes Wallace was there, there were experts from the ministry, and after debriefing, of course, we resumed to the mess, and one enormous party started even at that hour of the morning, which started for a while, and then we were all off to bed, and after a short sleep, we came back and resumed one tremendous party in the mess from a successful operation.
What was the atmosphere at the party?
Oh, one of elation, and elation in that it had been so successful, and depression to a certain extent that we had lost about 50% of the squadron, or 50% of the people that took off. Because of the 21 crews that had been chosen of the original squadron, actually 19 crews took off on the night of the operation. Two early returned. One had been severely hit by flak over the Dutch coast and lost all his radio communication and everything, and could not in any way continue. And the other one has also been hit and hit the Zyder Z and ripped his mine off, so he'd lost his mine. So two of them early returned. So that left 17 aircraft proceeding to the target. And of those 17 that proceeded to the target, 8 were lost. So it was very expensive in crews, but again, with hindsight, with the success of the raid, I would say that it was in every way worth it. I mean, even if we'd lost everybody and they'd had the success, it was a tremendous blow. And without a doubt, retarded the German war effort quite considerably. I think, again, talking with hindsight, it's easy to say after the event, but the Germans were able to rebuild the dams with much more speed and rapidity, I think, than had been thought by the pundits back at home. And it turns out, again with hindsight, that the reason that this was possible was that the explosions and the water took away the dam wall but left the foundations of those dams untouched. And so all they had to do was to rebuild a wall on top of foundations that were already there. I think perhaps that if Bomber Command had gone back the following night or within a very short space of time, and the Germans themselves, in some of the books that have been published since the war, say the same thing, and they couldn't understand why it wasn't done, that if they'd gone in there with high-level precision bombing, with deep penetration bombs, and blown away the foundations once the water had gone, there was no way that the Germans could have rebuilt those dams.
Have you any memories of Barnes Wallace that you would like to record?
Barnes Wallace was a most quiet, unassuming and charming man, and he was terribly, terribly distressed because he was sitting in the ops room back at Scampton right from the start of the morning in the briefing, right through the entire day and the entire night. I mean, he was there for virtually 24 hours. And of course, with the code messages that we were brought every time that we knew an aircraft had gone, radio signal was sent back to base saying that such and such had gone. And he got the messages when the dams had broken. He said or felt that he had not realized that there would be this tremendous sacrifice made of life. And he was absolutely in tears and quite pathetic on the following morning. But he was the most charming and most wonderful man, most wonderful man that ever was. And a brilliant, brilliant scientist.
Now, I think in 1944, you were on an operation concerned with D-Day. Could you tell me about that, please?
Yes, this is a very different type of operation to the operation that of the dam raid for which 617 was formed. But again, it was an operation carried out by 617 Squadron alone, carried out by 16 aircraft in two waves of eight aircraft each. The operation was called Operation Taxable, and it was, I think, one of the biggest spoofs that was ever played on the Germans. The raid was carried out on the night of the 5th of 6th of June, 1944, and the object of this exercise was to simulate a spoof landing of troop carriers and troop ships across the channel to the Calais area of France to try and put the Germans off the scent of where the real D-Day landing was going to take place down in Normandy. Now, to carry out this operation, again, it entailed a month's concentrated training, but of a very different type of training than the training we'd done for the dam raid. The training here was again accurate flying and very accurate navigation, but this time done with G and all the radar navigational aids that we had at that time. The object was for eight aircraft to fly in rectangular orbits, as it were, at a steady speed of 200 miles an hour at 3,000 feet, dropping out bundles of window, which window being strips of metal foil, which gave this stuff, once released into the air, gave a blip on the German radars. And they had, from intelligent sources, they had calculated and worked out that the radar blips appeared every 12 seconds. And so we had to drop out bundles of window every 12 seconds. Well, we flew in line abreast in, as I say, these rectangular, if you can call them rectangular orbits, where we would fly for 32 seconds ahead and then turn onto a reciprocal course and fly for 30 seconds and then turn again and fly ahead on a forward course for 32 seconds and then turn again and fly for 30 seconds so that you were doing getting a look slowly moving forward. This was done, as I say, we rendezvoused, took off from base at 11 o'clock on the night of the 5th of June, and we had to carry out this operation for a period of some 8 hours until dawn to give the impression that there was a tremendous beach landing about to take place in the Calais area to the Germans. We had to rendezvous and fly line abreast eight aircraft with a, something like a mile distance between the aircraft, but it was all pinpointed on the navigation, as I say, with the radar navigation. And the timing, all the timing was absolutely synchronized so that we all got on our positions and started at the same time. And travelling across the channel at that time below us were 18 small naval vessels towing barrage balloons, floating to barrage balloons, giving the clip so they get something. Well, this was a very, as I say, a very different operation from the one we'd done before. But we would, to do this, we trained special instrument flying and navigational exercises. In each aircraft, there were two pilots and two navigators because it was concentrated. The work was so concentrated that we had to have a break every so often. They couldn't continue with the concentration that was required. And we had three additional people in the aircraft with stopwatches dropping out the window through the flare chute in the belly of the aircraft. At 12-second intervals, they'd drop a bundle out, and as soon as it hit the airstream, it would scatter, and then they would get the blips coming through on the German screens. The only way that we know it was successful was that it did tie up a tremendous amount of German reserves in that area and stop them going down to where the actual landing took place. And we know that they thought something was happening because we could see from the French coast, all the coastal battalions and guns were firing the whole time, just aiming across at the channel, hoping that they would be lobbing some shells in amongst this spoof landing that was taking place. But again, looking back with hindsight, it was quite an interesting exercise to have done, and again with hindsight and the intelligence report that came through, it did prove successful. Although it was from the type of operations that we'd been doing on 617 Squadron, of course, it was a tremendous anticlimax.